Hello, Mike. And thank you. And hello, everyone else. And thank you, too, for joining Mike Coles of newliferadio.co.uk in Exeter and myself, Ron Bailey, BibleBase.com, for another episode of Broken Bread. And tonight, it's study number 16, Making of a Covenant. We're doing a study series on the book, The Better Covenant, that I wrote some years ago. And this is where we are up until this particular time. Having completed our backdrop to Abraham and his covenant, let's move forwards again in time to the Sinai Covenant. We've said that the Sinai Covenant was added or placed by the side of the Abraham Covenant. So it appears that on occasion covenants can sometimes operate side by side. At times, in fact, several covenants can operate side by side. So let's be sure that we don't confuse the covenants. The purpose of the Sinai Covenant. So what was the purpose or purposes of the Sinai Covenant? Well, it served as a restraint on outward sin. Where there is no revelation, the people cast away restraint. That's the real translation of Proverbs 29 and verse 18. Where there is no vision, that's to say no revelation, the people cast off restraint. But he that keepeth the law, happy is he. So it served as a restraint on outward sin and benefited individuals, families, and society. It also served to quantify or measure sin, making clear to the individual the measure or the exceeding sinfulness of his sin. In that sense, it served to show the helplessness of our human condition and the utter hopelessness of ever qualifying for acceptance with God by our own energies and efforts. This is what Paul writes in Romans chapter 7, verses 9 to 13, about the law. He said, I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. And the commandment, which was to bring life, I found to bring death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it killed me. Therefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy, and just, and good. Has then what is good become death to me? Certainly not. But sin, that it might appear sin, was producing death in me through what is good, so that sin, through the commandment, might become exceedingly sinful. And it served, as we saw in the book of Deuteronomy, as a tenancy agreement for the tenants of God's land. The law, basically, we often call it the Ten Commandments. It's more than that. But the Ten Commandments are the ten words. They are the core, the heart, of this particular instruction that were given to the people of Israel. And in Paul's letter to the saints in Rome, he reveals that there is a wider context for God's expectations of the way that men and women should work. It's the work of the law written on the hearts of all peoples. He says this in Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. For when the Gentiles, who do not have the law, by nature do the things in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them. The other nations, as to say the Gentiles, may not have the words of the law, the specifics, but they all have the work of the law written in their hearts, and conscience bears witness to that original work of the law. Paul goes on to reveal that above all the blessings that the people of the Sinai Covenant were to enjoy, the greatest was that they had received the words of God. This is Romans chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. What advantage, then, has the Jew? Or what is the profit of circumcision? Much, in every way, chiefly because to them were committed the oracles of God. They had the explicit words of the law, and consequently had no excuse for claiming ignorance of God's will. In Deuteronomy 29 and 20, verse 29, there is a really important truth that's encapsulated. This is Moses speaking to the people when they're on the threshold of entering the promised land, and he says this: "The secret things belong unto Jehovah our God, but the things that are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of the law." God does not hold us accountable for what we don't know, unless we have chosen not to know what he has declared. If we resolutely determine not to listen to what God is saying, then we must face the repercussions of that. The explicit law made it clear what they must do, that we may do all the words of this law. Paul will later on go to make it very clear that it's not just the doing that is the sin, but it's the thinking, it's the intending, it's the target. There's another interesting phrase in Amos chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. "Hear this word that Jehovah has spoken against you, O children of Israel, against the whole family which I brought up out of the land of Egypt, saying, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore I will visit upon you all your iniquities." For those who had clearer knowledge, the consequences of their failure would be increased. The covenant people would be held accountable for all their iniquities. You can contrast this with what God said to Jonah in chapter 4, verses 9 to 11. You remember that Jonah was complaining because God had done what Jonah knew he would do. As to say, when the people repented, he left off the impending judgment. And God said to Jonah, "Dost thou well to be angry for the good?" And he said, "I do well to be angry even unto death." And Jehovah said, "Thou hast had regard for the good, for which thou hast not labored, neither madest it grow, which came up in a night and perished in a night. And should not I have regard for Nineveh, that great city, where there are more than 60,000 persons that cannot discern between their right hand and their left, and also much cattle?" You can see that God is conscious of what we are conscious of. He knows what we know. He knows what he has said to us and how we've responded to it. The word in the city of Nineveh, more than 60,000. That's 1.2 million, I think. You can tell me if I'm wrong. "That cannot discern between their right hand and their left." There are some who had not grown to the stage of personal accountability. They were still learning things. They didn't know the right from the left. The clearer knowledge of God then and his will was to be a greater blessing for the people of Israel and a greater burden. I mentioned that the conscience bears witness. All peoples have an instinct or a moral sense. It may be almost buried under centuries of darkness, but men and women have a sense of what is fair, unless their consciences have become completely desensitized. They know how people ought to behave towards them, and consequently they know how they ought to behave towards other. Individuals may make brave or foolish claims that they are without law, and therefore free, but at heart, we all know this isn't true. This is going to be a unique covenant, and it will take place in a unique setting. Let's ask some questions then. Do you remember way back in the first study, I think, I made reference to Wycliffe and his questions. He said that when you turn to the scriptures and you read them, you need to be asking questions. To whom was this said? By whom was it said? In what context? Etc. And we have kind of coined our little phrase, context, context, context. Now, God is going to describe the context of this Sinai covenant with great precision. It was given to a specific group of people. It wasn't scattered into the public domain. Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 to 7. And God spake all these words, saying, I am Jehovah thy God, who brought thee out of the land of Egypt. Now, this is very specific. He's referring to people that he brought out of the land of Egypt, out of the hand of bondage. And he says to that people, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee a graven image, nor any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself unto them, nor serve them. For I, Jehovah, thy God, is going to become exclusively the God of this people. For I, Jehovah, thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, upon the third and upon the fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing loving kindness unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Thou shalt not take the name of, and here it is again, Jehovah thy God, in vain. For Jehovah will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. So the Ten Commandments, or the Ten Words, were not broadcast into the whole world. They were addressed to a very exclusive group of people, God's own nation. As a result of this covenant, God, Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, as Melchizedek had called him, would become Jehovah, Israel's God. That's the little phrase that so often in the Bibles we just see Lord God of Israel, and we read it so easily and we don't recognize the significance of it. It is actually Jehovah, Israel's God. He was, as Jehovah, the God who had committed to a definite project with this people, he was Israel's God. How about this one to show the significance of the context and the exclusive nature of the things that God is saying to this people? This is Exodus chapter 20 and verse 12. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long in the land which Jehovah thy God giveth thee. In its precise terms, this could only ever apply to the people of Israel. What do I mean? Well, it's a promise about the land that God is going to give to them. It's a promise that Jehovah, the God of Israel, is going to give to the people of Israel, that they may be in the land that we now often call Israel. In its precise terms, this could only ever apply to the people of Israel. So does that mean that non-Israelite children have no obligation toward their parents? Not at all. But it is significant to see how Paul actually changes this commandment when he is writing to non-Israelites. Here it is. This is Ephesians chapter 6, verses 1 to 3. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honour your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. The particular promise to a particular people in a particular destination has gone, and in its place we have a general promise of longevity in the earth. Then we need to recognize that the law, as we find it restated in the book of Deuteronomy, is a tenancy agreement. Deuteronomos, Deutero is second, and nomos is law. So this is the second giving, or the, you might say, the second application of the law. The book of Deuteronomy is a tenancy agreement. This second giving of the law is a renewing of the covenant, with the emphasis being reminded that their conquest and the ruling of the promised land will depend, upon them keeping the tenancy agreement of the Ten Commandments. This is Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 1 to 3, 40 years after they had first signed up to the Sinai covenant. Now this is the commandment, the statutes and the ordinances which Jehovah your God commanded to teach you, that you might do them in the land whither you go over to possess it, that thou mightest fear Jehovah thy God, to keep all his statutes and his commandments which I command thee, thou and thy son's son, all the days of thy life, and that thy days may be prolonged. Hear, O Israel, and observe to do it, that it may be well with thee, and that ye may increase mightily, as Jehovah the God of thy fathers hath promised unto thee, in a land flowing with milk and honey. Amazing promises, if the people kept to their word and kept to the covenant that they had agreed to embrace. We could pursue this covenant keeping being the basis for the conquest. We find that in the book of Joshua, but we'll just remain here at Sinai to examine its implications. This Sinai covenant is what we've called already a classical conditional covenant. Moses the deliverer now becomes Moses the mediator of a covenant between God and the people who have been redeemed from the bondage of Egypt. He's this little trio of statements that we've said so often. God brought them out, then he brought them to himself at Sinai, and conditional upon their covenant keeping, he would bring them into the promised land. He brought them out, he brought them to himself, he was going to bring them to the promised land. And in fact, each one is conditional on the one before it. God brought them out so that he could bring them to himself. He brought them to himself to engage in a covenant with them so that he could bring them into the promised land. So the scene is set. This is Exodus chapter 19, now verses 3 to 6. I love this little few sentences here. And Moses went up unto God, and Jehovah called unto him out of the mountain, saying, Thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, You have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings, and brought you unto myself. See how particular this is? Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then you shall be mine own possession from among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak to the children of Israel. We note again that this is addressed to a people who have already experienced redemption from Egypt, and its dark history was behind them. It's no longer a threat. For the first time in living memory, this people group is genuinely free to make its own choices. Now they are free to choose their own master. And we've said that this is a classical if-then-else pattern that puts the choice into their own hands. This is always the pattern. This is a key passage again from Romans chapter 10, verse 14 and 17 to 17, where Paul says how he's just said that those who call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. And he says, how then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? So in other words, they have to have faith. Salvation is by grace through faith. Paul believes that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation to all who believe. How shall they believe in him of whom they have not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher, a herald? How shall they preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace, who bring glad tidings of good things. But they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah says, who has believed our report? And then this succinct little just a few words, but listen to it. So then, this is the conclusion of what he said. Faith then comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. Now, do see the clarity of this pattern here. Really, we need to read this sentence backwards. The word of God has to start. This is biblical synergy. God initiates and empowers. Then man hears and believes, and then God completes the circle by effecting the salvation. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. It always initiates with God. It's always completely. He is the author and the finisher of this. And in the middle of it, a man or a woman has to believe. This is Exodus chapter 24, verse 3. And Moses came and told the people all the words of Jehovah and all the ordinances. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which Jehovah has spoken will we do. At this response, Moses then creates a handwritten copy of the covenant and its demands. It will be one of two copies of the law. The people's copy, in Moses' handwriting, this copy will become known as the Book of the Covenant. And then there's God's copy written in stone with the finger of God. And then there's a curious interlude that I'm calling the people, the book, and the altar. Moses himself creates a simple altar and erects 12 stone pillars to represent the 12 tribes of Israel. 12 individual representatives joined in an unbroken circle of service at the altar that Moses has built. First, Moses instructs the young men to conduct a whole burnt offering and a peace offering, forms of offerings that were much older than the Sinai covenant. Then the blood from the sacrifices is caught in a basin, and Moses himself sprinkles half of it on the altar and its burning sacrifices. Then he takes up the people's copy that he himself has written, the Book of the Covenant, and he reads it to the assembled crowds. For the third time, the enthusiasm of the people is expressed in a unanimous assent to the terms of the covenant. And then Moses himself now sprinkles the remainder of the blood onto the people themselves. And, according to the Epistle of Hebrews, is the detail that is added in Hebrews. You won't find this in Exodus. For when Moses had spoken every precept to all the people, according to the law, he took the blood of calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, this is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you. So the blood is sprinkled upon the altar and upon the people and upon the book, binding all three together inseparably. The only memorial left behind when the people of Israel moved away from Sinai was just the remains of this altar. It's a sobering reflection that if we had visited this spot a year later, the only evidence of the extraordinary happenings there would have been a rough altar with its 12 sentinel stone pillars, a silent testament to the fact that at this moment in history, in this place, this people became inseparably linked with the worship and service of God and to a sacred text. They became, my phrase, a Bible-based people. What was the outcome of this ritual? Well, according to the terms that God had instituted, this motley crew of refugees had now become a nation. God's nation. This is Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6. Now, therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be mine own possession from among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. The original Hebrew word for holy meant something separated to a particular purpose. Although all the nations of the earth owe allegiance to God, this nation had become uniquely and exclusively God's kingdom. In this nation, God's kingly rule would be worked out from this moment on, and as long as this covenant might last, God and this people would belong to each other exclusively for a purpose. And then the Bible regards this Sinai covenant as a marriage covenant. This is the prophet Ezekiel describing this moment, the Sinai moment, in the terms of a marriage contract. This is Ezekiel chapter 16 and verse 8, a very moving passage, particularly when you get to the latter half of it, and you see this glorious destiny and the tragedy that followed. Now when I passed by thee, I looked upon thee. Behold, thy time was the time of love, and I spread my skirt over thee, and covered thy nakedness. Yea, I swear unto thee, and entered into a covenant with thee, saith the Lord Jehovah, and thou becamest mine. This was the moment when the nation became the bride of Jehovah, and God never forgot these moments, although this marriage was to have a stormy history. Later on, not much later, but sometime later, Jeremiah in chapter 2 and verses 2 and 3 has this same picture in his mind, and he says, "Go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem, saying, Thus saith Jehovah, I remember for thee the kindness of thy youth, the love of thine espousals, how thou wentest after me in the wilderness in a land that was not sown. Israel was holiness unto Jehovah, entirely separated unto him. The first fruits of his increase. All that devour him shall be held guilty. Evil shall come upon them, saith Jehovah." It was Jeremiah who saw that first covenant as a betrothal and marriage, who later expressed the promised hope of another covenant against the backdrop of Israel's terrible failure. Jeremiah 31, verses 31 and 32. "Behold, the days come, saith Jehovah, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt," listen to this, "which my covenant they broke, although I was a husband unto them, says Jehovah." From the moment of this Sinai covenant, Israel's spiritual promiscuity would be called adultery by her prophets, and it becomes one of the great parables in which God declares his faithful love and his people's persistent faithlessness. So, in chapter 5 of the Better Covenant, we saw that the Sinai Covenant or the Ten Commandments was a local application of a universal moral law. Only the nation of Israel signed up to this particular expression of unchanging devotion and morality. But in every time and nation, mankind has known the truth of these principles upon which the commandments hang. We may not be able to quote the Ten Commandments, but the work of the Lord is written in the hearts of all mankind, everywhere. And we saw that by the terms of this covenant, that God and Israel were joined together as in a marriage, and Israel's betrayal of the covenant would be regarded as spiritual adultery. In chapter 5 of the Better Covenant, we saw that the Sinai Covenant, or the Ten Commandments, was a local application of a universal moral law. Only the nation of Israel signed up to this particular expression of unchanging devotion and morality, but in every time and nation, mankind has known the truth of these principles upon which these commandments hang. We may not be able to quote the Ten Commandments, But the work of the law is written in the hearts of all mankind everywhere. And we saw that by the terms of this covenant, that God and Israel were joined as in a marriage, and Israel's betrayal of the covenant was spiritual adultery. What a glorious prospect! What a wreckage this marriage became. It really is a tragic story. The story of God's broken heart and a broken marriage. And we'll leave it there for this study, trusting in the will of God to see you same time, same place next week as we continue these studies. God bless you. Goodbye.